The history of the United States and Iran is a rather sad one in the last 37 years, and there's been plenty of offenses committed by both sides. The list is very, very long. And this is one of the main achievements of this deal, that the both sides recognize they will never be able to sort out the past, but they can sort out the future. The main problem now is that not only has the Trump administration tried to kill the deal, but the Trump administration itself is actually in violation of the deal because they're actively undermining what is now legal trade between Iran and the outside world. I mean, sanctions that have been lifted are lifted, but the Trump administration is pressuring countries not to trade with Iran. This is an explicit violation of the deal.
That's Trita Parsi, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Trita Parsi on the Iran deal. The self-styled dealmaker is a deal breaker when it comes to the historic agreement limiting Iranian uranium enrichment in return for the lifting of sanctions. Trump refused to certify Iranian compliance and passed the ball to Congress, which now must decide. But the UN monitoring agency has determined that Tehran is adhering to the conditions agreed to. Does the United States have evidence indicating otherwise? Why is Trump now abrogating the deal and insulting Iran as a rogue state? Iran, once in Washington's hip pocket under the Shah, broke away with its 1979 Islamic Revolution. The U.S. has been hostile ever since. If the deal collapses, why would any country, say North Korea, enter into an agreement with Washington? It changes what has been negotiated post facto. In this case, the old saw applies. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Our guest today is Trita Parsi. He's president of the National Iranian American Council and is the author of several books on U.S.-Iranian relations, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. I talked with him in Denver. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
JCPOA, the awkward acronym for the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal. Five permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany, signed it after long negotiations in Vienna on Bastille Day, actually, July 14, 2015. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, conducts inspections of Iranian sites. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, former governor of South Carolina, was in Vienna, apparently pushing or interrogating the staff there as to what's happening with these inspections. And the big question, is Iran in compliance?
So you're putting your finger on something that is really important. First of all, the Iranians are in compliance. There are 8 reports by the IAEA, the Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, who has been tasked to oversee the implementation of this deal. They are the referee on matters of violation. And they have 8 times in a row now certified that the Iranians are living up to the deal. And in some cases, they're actually living up to beyond the deal. The Trump administration has been seeking ways to kill the deal. And while the president himself seems to have preferred just walking out, even though it would be very costly to the United States, he doesn't seem to care because he doesn't seem to understand. Other people in his administrations were pushing a different approach, same goal, kill the deal, but a different approach. And one of those approaches was to use a mechanism within the deal in which one can request access for the inspectors to visit non-nuclear sites inside of Iran. This is a mechanism that is in place in order to make sure that if the Iranians secretly are doing something elsewhere, the IAEA should be able to go there and look. What is required, however, is that you present the IAEA with credible evidence. If the IAEA doesn't have credible evidence but is pushed into doing this, the result will be that they won't find anything. And after the third time of doing this and not finding anything, it's the credibility of the IAEA that gets killed. So the IEA has a reason to resist. But the Trump administration's calculation was, if we strong-arm the IAEA and push them to request access to sites where we don't have any evidence that something fishy is going on, the Iranians will say no. And once the Iranians say no, we can say, the Iranians are in violation. And that way you can get out of the deal while passing the blame and the cost onto Tehran. Nikki Haley went to IAEA. She got a very firm response by the IAEA, saying that they have no reason to do this. She had no new evidence that she presented to them. She was only trying to strong-arm them into doing something. And it failed. It failed quite miserably. And ever since, we have not heard the Trump administration seeking that path towards killing the deal. Instead, they're seeking other paths.
The Defense Secretary Mattis says the deal is, I'm quoting, in our best interests. And apparently the Secretary of State Tillerson, National Security Advisor McMaster, and other government officials, as well as scores of disarmament experts, have said that this is a good deal.
Without a doubt. I just published my book on the deal. I was in a unique position throughout these negotiations because I was on the one hand advising the Obama administration, and on the other hand, I also had access to the Iranians, so it wasn't unusual. I could be at the White House early in the week, and at the end of the week, during the talks, I would have a two-hour private session with the Iranian foreign minister, and gave me a chance to see things up front, very close, and get both sides' perspectives, their calculations, their fears, their tactics and strategies. I also interacted a lot with the scientific community as part of the research for the deal. And within the scientific community, the value of this deal is as established as climate change is. Questioning the deal on scientific basis is as silly as it is to question whether climate change exists. This is not a scientific question. This is a political question. The science of this is absolutely solid. The Iranians essentially have no chance of being able to find the path to a nuclear bomb as long as this deal survives. If Trump kills the deal, of course, then that's a completely different matter. But this is the toughest inspections regime that ever has been put into place. And there's no alternative to this that in any way, shape, or form would measure up to the science that is the foundation of this deal. And incidentally, part of the reason why the science was so much part of this is because Ernest Moniz, the Secretary of Energy, was a lead negotiator. He is a nuclear physicist from MIT. His counterpart on the Iranian side was another MIT PhD, Ali Akbar Salehi. They were actually at MIT at the same time, both of them nuclear physicists. Whenever the United States tested a model or made a proposal to the Iranians and the Iranians made some revisions to it, the U.S. side would take that revised version back to the scientific community. They actually modeled it. They tested it. Is there a way for the Iranians to cheat if we do it this way? And once everything was solidly on scientific grounds, that's when it was okayed.
It's kind of ironic that three states that have nuclear weapons and the ballistic missile delivery systems capabilities are Israel, India, and Pakistan. None is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. I've been to Iran several times, and people bring this up in terms of there's a double standard for Israel, India, and Pakistan, and another special standard for Iran. Is Iran being held to special, unique criteria?
I think in many ways, yes. Obviously, all of this is happening in a political context. And in this specific case, it's happening in a geopolitical context in which the main driving force behind pushing this onto the top of the international agenda was Israel, who itself has weapons and is not a signatory. But there was also a risk, incidentally, that instead of a double standard, this could have led to a quadruple standard. Let me explain why. During the negotiations, it was critical for the Iranians to make sure that there would be a deal that, yes, it would punish them for what they have done in the past, but it would give a path so that the Iranians would end up being able to once again be a full NPT partner, a signatory, which means that within the NPT, there are countries that have weapons and there are countries that don't have weapons. And then there's a third category. There are countries that are not within the NPT and have weapons. Israel, Pakistan, India, now, of course, North Korea, since they walked out of the NPT. This was essential because some on the Western side wanted the punishment to be permanent, which meant that Iran would have become a fourth category, a country that would be part of the NPT, would live up to the NPT requirements eventually, but would permanently be treated differently. This was absolutely unacceptable to the Iranians. That's why you have a scenario in which certain aspects of the restrictions on the Iranians are going to be lifted on year 10, on year 15, granted that the Iranians have lived up to the deal by then, meaning that they have restored international confidence that Iran's program is solely peaceful. Once that confidence is there, Iran should be able to be no different from Sweden, Belgium, Japan. But there were some who were pushing to make sure that that's not the case, and there are some right now that are pushing that. Benjamin Netanyahu, when he was giving his recent talk on this, was insisting that there should be no sunset, as he called it. There really is no sunset, but what he's referring to is that some restrictions would be lifted once the Iranians have lived up to the test. That is to turn Iran into a fourth category nation, the only country that would be part of the NPT but not enjoy the rights of the NPT.
Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, incidentally, is under investigation for various transgressions. He says it's 1938 and Iran is Germany.
So Netanyahu has more than any Israeli leader in the last 20 years pushed to make Iran an existential threat, or define it as an existential threat. It's funny because by doing this, of course, his calculation was that he would eliminate the status quo option, meaning the idea that the United States could just contain the Iranian nuclear program and kick the can down the road and let it be the headache of the next administration. He did so because he thought by eliminating the status quo option, he would force the United States to take action, military action. Because if you have an existential threat that is growing, eventually the United States would have to take military action, particularly since the Israelis were constantly pushing to make sure that there could not be any compromise on this issue. But in a bizarre way, this deal may have come about not in spite of Netanyahu, but because of Netanyahu. Because you see, by eliminating the status quo option, he forced the United States to take action. He thought that he could force the United States to take military action. And he underestimated Obama and he misread America in the sense that the public was so adamantly against another war. They were so tired of war. That actually pushed Obama into the diplomatic direction. Had Netanyahu not done this, had he not eliminated the status quo option, I'm personally convinced the chances are that President Obama would not have made that immense and very costly and very risky investment in going down that more than two-year-long diplomatic path with the Iranians. So in some ways, bizarrely, we may have to have Netanyahu to thank for getting this deal.
AIPAC is universally acknowledged as one of the most influential and most powerful and well-funded lobbies. What kind of influence does the Israeli lobby have on policy?
The influence of the right-wing Israeli lobby, meaning the groups that tend to be very close to the Likud's view, AIPAC, of course, is the leading one, are quite powerful. But I would say that over the course of the last 10 years, while still powerful, their strong position of dominance has really reduced and shrunk significantly. You see, they spent between $20 and $40 million the summer of 2015, and they lost. They had
on advertisements denouncing
advertisements
the deal
and everything else, trying to kill the deal. Not only did they lose, they end up getting less Democrats on their side at the end of the process than they had in the beginning of the process. I think what we saw here, as well as what we saw in August 2013, when there was a vote on whether to authorize military force against Syria, was that these groups that have earned a reputation of being hegemonic and dominant on their issues are dominant as long as the American public is absent. But once you have mass mobilization by the American public, which only can happen on very, very few issues and very, very specific moments when the constellation is such that they can, you know, tune out Paris Hilton and the Kardashians for a quick moment and focus on something more important, and they massively mobilize, then we see that these groups, as powerful as they are no longer dominant, and they oftentimes lose. That's exactly what happened in 2013. Rightly or wrongly, there was mass mobilization to push back against Congress authorizing military force in Syria. AIPAC lobbied in favor of military action. The defense industry lobbied in favor of military action. President Obama lobbied in favor of military action. Yet, most members of Congress that we've spoken to said that they got 97 phone calls against military action to 3 in favor. Same thing happened during the summer of 2015. The calls in favor or the calls against the deal were larger in number. But the calls in favor were still so numerous, so strong, quite unprecedented, that it was sufficient to be able to win the case.
Now, the conventional wisdom about the deal and how it evolved is that the sanctions were really hurting Iran. They were desperate to get out of them, and that's what brought them to the table. You say that Obama made a diplomatic move that was quite dramatic. Explain what happened.
This narrative in Washington that sanctions is what brought the Iranians to the table and they were so desperate so that they caved is really not true. And it's very dangerous for us to lull ourselves into believing that, drinking our own Kool-Aid, because that will give us a false understanding of what actually made this deal work, this deal that no one thought could be achieved. And then we will apply the wrong model, the false model, on future cases such as North Korea today. In order to understand what went right, we have to be honest with ourselves. What actually did go right here? And when you see what happened in the secret negotiations in Oman that no one knew about at the time, you see a very different picture. Let me start here. January 2012, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta publicly says that Iran's breakout capability is 12 months, meaning the moment they will decide to build the material for a bomb, to them having the material will take 12 months. January 2013, a new sense of urgency dawns on the White House because it turns out that Iran's breakout capability had shrunk to 8 to 12 weeks. This is as a result of the U.S. imposing sanctions on Iran and the Iranians responding deliberately by doubling down on their nuclear program. And the question then was, which clock ticks the fastest? Is it the sanctions clock or is it the nuclear clock? Will the U.S. be able to cripple the Iranian economy first, or will the Iranians be able to present the United States with a nuclear fait accompli first? This was a race. By January 2013, the president understands that the nuclear clock was not ticking faster. If nothing else changed, the United States would be faced with only two options, either accepting that Iran is becoming a de facto nuclear power or go to war. The thing that could change is if the United States finally, for the very first time, made a diplomatic play that Obama had planned to do, but he had planned to do it at the end of a negotiation, not in the beginning of the negotiation. And that is to go to the Iranians and say, we accept your red line. We accept that you can have enrichment on your soil, which was the absolute red line of the Iranians. They would never compromise on this. regardless of how much pressure and sanctions they were put on. And I interviewed tons of the negotiators from all sides on this, and I got their own quotes and their stories of what actually happened in the secret talks. I also spoke to the folks on the Omani side about this. So March 2013, Ahmadinejad is still president. We're not talking about the Rouhani years. Obama allows a senior delegation of diplomats to go to Oman. This would be the second meeting. The first meeting was in July of 2012. It was a very bad meeting. Nothing good came out of it. But this time around, he sends a senior delegation, including the number two at the State Department, Ambassador Bill Burns. And for the very, very first time, he allows the American diplomats to have an instrument in their hands that they were not allowed to have before, which was a carefully worded statement on how and when and under what circumstances the United States would be willing to concede the issue of enrichment to the Iranians. This happened during the Ahmadinejad years, and that's the breakthrough that then led to the negotiations that eventually got this deal. Of everyone that I've interviewed in the White House, Europeans, Russians, the Iranians, had this not been made, has this concession not been made, we would not be seeing a deal right now. And in reverse, if this concession had been made 10 years earlier, we could have had a deal 10 years earlier that would have been better than the deal the United States got now, because during those 10 years when the U.S. was pursuing sanctions, the Iranians were advancing their program. As the sanctions gave the United States more leverage in a negotiation, so did the new number of centrifuges that the Iranians were constantly adding and the knowledge that they amassed about the fuel cycle. So we could have gotten a deal 10 years ago without these sanctions, with the Iranians keeping much less centrifuges and having much less knowledge about the fuel cycle, if we had adopted a more realistic position back then instead of waiting this long and then conceding this in 2013. And the story then is, we could have gotten a better deal 10 years before we started imposing these sanctions.
Well, that goes, I think, back to the whole context of U.S.-Iranian relations, which have been more than murky since the overthrow of the Shah in 1978-79 and the introduction of the Islamic regime of Ayatollah Khomeini. That relationship, once very close, became quickly estranged to the point where, when Iraq invades Iran, a clear violation of international law and treaties, the United States not only did not impose sanctions on Iraq, but in fact gave it billions of dollars of credits and weapons.
Absolutely. The history of the United States in Iran is a rather sad one in the last 37 years, and there's been plenty of offenses committed by both sides. The list is very, very long. And this is one of the main achievements of this deal, that the both sides recognize they will never be able to sort out the past, but they can sort out the future. And they were willing to be able to set aside some of the grievances of the past in order to make sure that there wouldn't be new grievances coming up. That's why my book is called Losing an Enemy. I'm not making the argument that the United States lost an enemy. I'm making the argument that there was an opportunity to lose an enemy, an opportunity that had to be embraced and built upon, an opportunity that now has been squandered by the Trump administration. Because instead of building on this deal, he's looking for ways of killing this deal. And this is quite sad, because we have to ask ourselves, when was the last time the United States lost an enemy in the Middle East?
Well, at the UN in late September, Trump called the deal an embarrassment to the United States, one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the U.S. has ever entered into. And interestingly, he also said this on other occasions, that under the deal, we gave Iran $150 billion. And according to him, we get nothing in return.
Which is, of course, completely false. There was no $150 billion from the U.S. that went to the Iranians. What existed was that as part of the sanctions, the money Iran held in foreign banks, primarily in Switzerland, Japan, elsewhere, which they used to pay for their imports from those countries, were frozen, and the Iranians didn't have access to that money. As part of the deal, that money was unfrozen, and the Iranians regained access to it. It was Iran's own money. It wasn't America's money. There is a much smaller amount of money that was transferred, which is roughly $1.7 billion. And that was because of a lawsuit between the United States and Iran, in which the Iranians had bought weaponry, airplanes, I believe, during the last years of the Shah. The Shah's government had paid the United States that money. But in between him paying and the Americans being able to deliver, the Iranians had a revolution and they took 52 American diplomats hostage. So the United States did not give the money back, nor did it send the airplanes to Iran. The Iranians take the United States to the international court, and that court case was about to come to a head. It was very clear the United States would have lost. The original sum was $400 million, but with interest, it would be $1.7 million. It would be a negotiation, and the United States decided to negotiate a deal, an agreement with the Iranians, rather than letting the legal procedures continue. Chances are that if they had let the legal procedures continue, it would probably have led to $5 or $6 billion. Instead, they settled for $1.7. The president even announced this on the very same day that the nuclear deal was implemented. It didn't make much news. But then suddenly, 6 months later, became major news for a very simple reason. The Wall Street Journal found out that the money had actually been sent to the Iranians in cash on airplanes. There was nothing new in the story except for the fact that this was hand-delivered to the Iranians in cash. The reason why it was given in cash was because of U.S. sanctions. U.S. sanctions made it very difficult for any bank to agree to transfer that amount of money from an American bank to the Iranians. So the U.S. itself was forced to do this through a cash payment. But this is one of many, many falsehoods that was spread about the deal during that summer. Some of it spread, of course, by Trump himself, and he's continued to peddle those lies.
The New York Times reports Mr. Rouhani, the president of Iran, a moderate, has staked his reputation on sealing the nuclear deal and relieving the Iranian economy of debilitating international sanctions. How much has Rouhani invested political capital in the success of this deal?
This has been quite essential for him, to the extent that there's a lot of criticism that he has neglected other issues at the expense of the nuclear deal. But I think he, from his perspective, he recognized that this is such an important agreement. It is such an important challenge that was standing in front of the Iranians, that unless they resolve this issue, so many other problems would continue to exist. So in order to get out of the isolation Iran was, this issue needed to be resolved, but it needed to be resolved in a way that he could also defend it at home. The main problem now is that not only has the Trump administration tried to kill the deal, but the Trump administration itself is actually in violation of the deal because they're actively undermining what is now legal trade between Iran and the outside world. I mean, sanctions that have been lifted are lifted, but the Trump administration is pressuring countries not to trade with Iran. This is an explicit violation of the deal.
You're listening to Trita Parsi on the Iran deal. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. In terms of the political structures in Iran, one often hears the term hardliner and reformer. What do these terms mean in the Iranian context? Who's who here?
There's different ways of being able to categorize the different factions within Iranian politics. None of them are entirely accurate. Most of them hold a significant amount of truth, however. What you have right now is a new phenomenon with Rouhani, because Rouhani was never a reformist. He was a centrist pragmatist. He was much closer to Rafsanjani. He was on the opposite side of the reformist president, Muhammad Khatami, back in the late 1990s. But over the years, Khatami and Rafsanjani managed to spearhead an effort to create an alliance between the pragmatist and the reformist, even though they were very strongly at odds with each other 20 years ago. And it's that coalition that led to the victory of Rouhani. Rouhani would not have won had it not been for the reformist votes, if it had not been for the votes of the people who were out in the streets only 4 years earlier supporting Mousavi and Karoubi and the Green Movement. That is ultimately his base of support. Then, of course, you have various factions of conservatives. They were very skeptical about the deal, but it's not because of the deal per se. It's not even because they are ideologically opposed to a deal with the United States. All of those who were making that argument in Washington as a way of, oh, a deal would never work with Iran, have been proven utterly wrong. That was actually an ideological hiccup on the American side more so than the Iranian side. The problem for the conservatives is not a deal. It's not a deal with the U.S. It's the aftermath of the deal. Will the deal be a stepping stone for a larger U.S.-Iran rapprochement? And if that is the case, will the United States be able to move into Iran economically, gain influence? And if that happens, the conservatives' grip over the Iranian economy will start to weaken, and that would ultimately affect the balance of power domestically within Iran between conservatives and reformists, etc. So their opposition is not so much because of ideological hiccups, etc. This is ultimately about their own power and the fear that an opening up of Iran to the West entirely would ultimately be very detrimental to their interests. They are not incorrect in that analysis, in my view. I think that's precisely why the reformers want to open up Iran, because they do recognize that an Iran that is more open to the outside world, that has more normal interaction, will also be an Iran in which the conservative faction will shrink.
Rouhani and, you mentioned, Rafsanjani, both clerics. Rafsanjani passed away in early 2017. How do they line up, or how does Rouhani line up in opposition to the supreme leader who holds ultimate power in the country?
So part of the reason why Rouhani has been able to be a bit more effective than what a reformist president was under Khatami and potentially other reformist presidents is precisely because he has a different working relationship with Khamenei. And his modus operandi has not necessarily been to oppose and confront Khamenei directly, but to bring him to his side. And Khamenei's red line is essentially is don't cross me. Don't cross the institution of the Velayat-e Faqih, which Rouhani has not done.
Explain what that is. It's a unique Iranian concept.
It is a unique Iranian concept that was put together by Ayatollah Khomeini, which essentially is that Iran has a political system. He has a president, he has a parliament, he has a guardian council, an assembly of experts. But he has, above all of that, a supreme ayatollah, a grand ayatollah, who is the Velayat-e Faqih, the supreme leader. He is essentially the balancer of the system. He is the person who holds most power in the country, more so than the president. But he doesn't hold complete power. This is not a Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein type of a system. More than anything else, he's the balancer, but he's a balancer with his own strong tilt towards the conservative side, of course.
How would you characterize the Iranian economy today, its strength and its weaknesses? Is it a kind of state capitalist system?
This is actually one of the interesting criticisms against Rouhani by some people on the reformist side and elsewhere in Iran, which is that he's a strong neoliberal, and he's pursuing such reforms and changes in Iran society, which is meeting the same type of resistance as we see to neoliberal policies elsewhere. It is effective in creating growth, but it is effective in creating growth at the expense of massive inequality, and Iran has significant inequality right now, plausibly, potentially more so than it did even during the time of the Shah. But one of the main problems for the Iranian economy right now is that the sanctions relief simply hasn't worked. Rouhani needs to create a lot of jobs. His economy is growing at 6.6 or so percent this year. But that is mainly because he's able to sell more oil compared to it was before, because the oil sanctions relief has worked. But to create jobs, you can't just sell oil. You have to have investments. And when you only sell oil, it strengthens the state companies, not the private sector. So we've seen significant growth in Iran, but we haven't seen unemployment shrink as much. And unemployment has further suffered by the fact that he has been very aggressive in trying to push down inflation, and he got it down from roughly 40 to 10%. So that is a significant achievement, but that also comes at the expense of other things. And the combination of pushing down inflation and not having investments that would create jobs, because pushing down investments actually tends to do the opposite, has created a situation in which a lot of people are not terribly happy with the economy. But then still giving Rouhani political support, because he's still seen as a better candidate, an alternative, than anyone that the conservatives have put forward.
The militaries in Pakistan, Turkey, Egypt, and in other countries have a major economic power. Does the Iranian Revolutionary Guard also have economic influence?
They have significant economic power. And they are corrupt. They are operating like a mafia. And they are right now in a confrontation with Rouhani. Rouhani has arrested several of their leaders. Because he recognizes, of course, that they're getting too much power, but also that it's very difficult for the Iranian economy to really pick up and get investments to come in if you have this shady, essentially, oligarchy run by the IRGC that is above the law, doesn't open up its book, doesn't even necessarily pay taxes, etc. So that needs to be dismantled in order for Iran's economy to become more transparent and more functional. But that is one of the biggest fault lines in Iranian politics right now, that between Rouhani and the IRGC.
Aren't the Revolutionary Guards under the control of the Supreme Leader, Khamenei?
Ostensibly, yes. But they are a very, very big movement. And much of what is happening right now is that former IRGC officials have moved into the economic sector. And they have a very strong network there, and they are not necessarily abiding by the rules. Again, Khamenei is a balancer. Khamenei seems to be in agreement that they have become perhaps a little bit too big and has not objected, or at least not stood in the way of Rouhani clamping down. I don't think we should expect that Khamenei will approve a complete dismantlement of the IRGC's economic empire.
All countries have security concerns. Three of Iran's neighbors are quite unstable, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Iran was subjected to an ISIS attack in June of 2017, an attack on the parliament, an attack on the mausoleum of Ayatollah Khomeini. What are Iran's concerns in terms of its security?
It's a great question. I think the answer might surprise you. The Iranian National Security Council has defined as their top threat sectarianism. And the reason, and the combination of sectarianism with Salafi jihadism. And the reason for this is because, yes, the United States has a very mighty military, and it can definitely take out the Iranian military. But if the United States were to start a war, you would see a massive rally around the flag phenomenon in Iran, and the country would essentially unite. Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other jihadi groups don't have that military power, but they have the opposite power. They have the power of creating division within Iran society. Iran has ethnic minorities, Sunni Arab minorities. Some of them have very legitimate grievances with the central government. And just as much as ISIS and Al-Qaeda have managed to move into areas elsewhere where there are disgruntled groups, whether they're minorities or not, doesn't necessarily matter. The Iranians are worried about this because that type of penetration can create internal problems that are much more difficult for the Iranians to deal with. Guess then what the second national security threat is, according to the Iranian National Security Council. Climate change. Iran is going to be disproportionately affected at a very early stage as a result of climate change. Most of the areas where food is grown in Iran, and Iran is essentially self-sufficient on food, is going to dry out very soon. It's going to be hit with massive heat waves as a result of this. The Iranians don't have the technology to be able to resist this. And ultimately, no one single country can handle this problem alone. The Iranians are painfully aware of not only this problem, but also the lack of capacity of addressing it.
Talk about the Trump-imposed travel ban, singling out Iran and other Muslim-majority countries. Your organization very strongly opposed that.
Yes, because this ban has nothing to do with U.S. security. This is not aimed at making America safer. This is aimed at him giving red meat to his base. He promised them a Muslim ban. He's giving them a Muslim ban. And even though he's suffered significant setbacks in courts, visas to many Muslim countries, including those who were on the original ban as well as the current ban, have gone down between 30 and 50%. So he's getting his Muslim ban despite what the courts have decided. That's why we are fighting not just in the courts but also in Congress. Ultimately, this is going to have to be prohibited by Congress itself, we believe, particularly with the constellation that we have in the Supreme Court right now. If this was based on a need to secure America, then we would have started off with the countries where a threat actually emanates, whether it is because of the government there doing something or because of movements there creating something. And we would have started off with Saudi Arabia, where so much of this problem has come from and where so many people who have attacked the United States and elsewhere have been radicalized. San Bernardino is an example. Pakistani citizens radicalized in Saudi Arabia. Of the countries that Trump put on the Muslim ban the first time around, not a single American has been killed in a terrorist attack on U.S. soil by a citizen of any of those countries. Whereas 94.1% of all Americans killed in terrorist acts on U.S. soil committed by a foreign national were committed by nationals of the Saudis, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Egypt. None of them are addressed in this ban. And in fact, the first country Trump went to was Saudi Arabia, and he gave them a massive hug, and he told them explicitly, we're not here to criticize. I'm not making an argument that Saudi Arabia should have been on a Muslim ban. I'm making the argument that this has nothing to do with American security. Just take this example. Sudan was actually originally on one of these. It's not on the third version of the Muslim ban. Guess why? Well, because the UAE lobbied to get them off the Muslim ban in return for the Sudanese sending mercenaries to help the UAE fight the Houthis in Yemen.
Talk about the conflict with Saudi Arabia. Is this two countries, Iran, Saudi Arabia, vying for hegemony or power in the Middle East? And the Saudi foreign minister, Adel Jubeir, says, I'm quoting, Iran remains the single main sponsor of terrorism in the world, and it's determined to upend the order in the Middle East.
The two very strong statements that give us good insight in Saudi thinking. On the first statement, it is a more accurate statement to describe Saudi Arabia as such. That's not to say that the Iranians have not been involved in terrorism. But there's very little of that, if any, we can point to since 2001. Saudi role in all of this, of course, is quite extensive, including in 9/11 itself, in which the redacted 28 pages do show that Saudi, very senior Saudi officials, including the ambassador in Washington at the time, Bandar, had contact and provided aid to the Saudis that ended up doing the 9/11 attacks.
That evidence is convincing in your view?
that evidence is convincing that there's something there and we stopped searching. There's certainly something there that should have been investigated and we didn't for political reasons because of the contacts between and the relations between the Bush administration, the Bush family and the Saudis. I mean, remember, Bandar's nickname was Bandar Bush. That's how close he was to the Bush family and the Bin Laden family that was in Washington, D.C., including in Georgetown University, were flown out with the help of the FBI, the same evening of 9/11. It's not enough to be able to say with certainty that the Saudis were there, but it's enough to say something seemed to have been there. We should have investigated it. Instead, there was a political decision to shut down that investigation. Why was that decision made? If there was nothing there, what were you worried about? On the other issue, that's actually a very interesting point that Jubair is making. He said that Iran is trying to upend the order in the region. That's a very strong misread of the Saudis, but it tells you something about what they want. The order in the region was upended in 2003. The previous order was an order that the Saudis preferred. They want to go back to it. It was a dual containment. The United States had strong hegemony in the region. It was an order that was centered on Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, and it was based on Iran and Iraq's exclusion and containment. It was called dual containment. The Iranians hated that order. They did everything they could to cause its collapse, but it wasn't the Iranians that killed it. It was the United States, because George Bush went into Iraq. He thought that he could create a different order that would be less costly for the U.S. by just removing problematic states from his perspective. He failed so miserably because he did manage to kill that order, but he did not manage to create a new order. And in the process, he weakened himself to the point in which the United States ever since have not been in a position to have the capacity to impose on the Middle East a new equilibrium. So there is no order. The region has been orderless since 2003. The Saudis are living in a dream world. They think that there is an order, the Iranians are upending it, and that the United States should restore it to pre-2003 balance of power. There's only two ways you can do that. You can either do that by making Iraq and Afghanistan splendid successes, and by that have them continue to balance Iran the way it was prior to the 2003 war. Or, if that's not possible, which it clearly is not, at least not possible for the United States, you have to cut down Iran in size by taking military action. And that's exactly what the Saudis wanted throughout this entire period. And now with Trump, they see their chance of being able to get an administration that is so clueless about the geopolitics of the world to actually be able to sell them this idea.
And the wars being fought in Syria and Yemen are called proxy wars, where outside states are involved, including Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Yes, and the Saudis have essentially lost in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, and in Lebanon. And I understand their calculation. They obviously don't want to negotiate with the Iranians right now because they're in a very, very significant position of weakness. That's why the Iranians have kept on reaching out to the Saudis, and the Saudis have rebuffed them. They don't want to negotiate because they have such a weak position. And then with Trump coming in, why would they want to resolve this issue right now? Why not wait to see what is Trump willing to do? How far can we push Trump towards challenging Iran, perhaps bombing Iran? And then we'll negotiate. Until you know how far you can drag and lure Trump into this, it's completely rational for the Saudis not to want to negotiate. But ultimately, we have to recognize Iran cannot wish away Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia cannot wish away Iran. These two countries are going to have to come to some sort of an understanding. So Obama told the king of Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah at the time, that you have to find a way to share the region with the Iranians. The Saudis were deeply offended by this because essentially what Obama was said, I'm not going to commit U.S. resources any longer for an all-out containment of Iran because, A, it doesn't work, it further destabilizes the region, and it actually is no longer in our interest because we just struck a nuclear deal with Iran. it just makes so much more sense for you, Saudi Arabia, to find a way to get along with Iran instead of thinking that you can fight Iran to the last American.
And what about the vibrancy of civil society?
This is, in my view, one of the reasons why I'm very hopeful about Iran, which is that it has a very vibrant civil society, has a very educated public. It has a public that recognizes that the best path for them to be able to get the change that is so needed in Iran is through the ballot box, is through peaceful means. They've gone through a revolution. They don't see a need to be that dumb again, to be completely frank. Revolutions don't bring about that type of positive change. And particularly after seeing how the Arab Spring has fared, you really have to be quite disconnected from the realities of Iran to wish that for Iran. I remember a very vivid scene weeks after Rouhani won the elections, which was a major win for the Green Movement, because the Green Movement was the core of his supporters in the voting bloc. You had the massacre in Cairo, in which Sisi and that coup that was made, and about 1,500 people were killed in the streets of Cairo that on a single day. And Iranians put pictures of Cairo on fire on their Facebook, and it said revolution on top of that picture. Then they had a picture of Iranian women dancing in the streets after Rouhani had been elected. And over that picture, they said evolution. It was very clear in my idea that this is, in my mind, that this is a very sophisticated population that has understood. They're faced with problems that no country should face. They're faced with problems that their government has created for them. But a peaceful, controllable, gradual path has a far higher likelihood of success than rushing towards yet another revolution.
And if you were to close your eyes for a moment to imagine a different future between Iran and the United States, what would that look like to you?
What I would like to see is the two sides losing each other as enemies. That does not necessarily mean that they will become great friends. I think there will be a rivalry remaining between the two sides. As long as the United States seeks to have a strong presence in the Middle East, it will be at odds with Iran. But that doesn't mean that it needs to be an enmity. But I think it's important to eliminate this all-out enmity, because that all-out enmity not only destabilizes the Middle East, does not serve U.S. or Iranian interests, but it also has a very negative effect on Iran's internal development, its ability to be able to move towards a much more freer and democratic society, driven not by any outside force, but by the Iranian people themselves.
I've been talking to Trita Parsi. He's the president of the largest Iranian-American grassroots organization in the United States, the National Iranian-American Council. He's the author of Treacherous Alliance, A Single Roll of the Dice, and most recently, Losing an Enemy. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You were just listening to an interview I did with Trita Parsi on the Iran deal. I talked with him in Denver. Trita Parsi is president of the National Iranian American Council and the author of several books on U.S.-Iranian relations. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Richard Wolff, Vandana Shiva, Noam Chomsky, Tariq Ali, Chris Hedges, and Angela Davis. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Trita Parsi on the Iran deal, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Nader Hashmi. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Iranian classical music performed on the ney, the flute, by Hossein Omoumi. Yeah.